Okay, so now I'd like to introduce our second old timer, Robert, from Saturday Morning Chelsea Beginners Meeting. Was Whiskey Pete was the first old timer you came across at the Aldgate East Lunchtime Meeting? And then there was also Ironing Board Arthur. The names are great. This is what I love. I love about hearing about all these people and the names. So I will hand over to you, Robert.
Hello. Good morning. My name is Robert Nelson. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Robert.
And it's nice to be here. It's just a pity there's not a wee bit more people here. Not to hear me, but to support the idea. It's not the smallest meeting. In 1978, I was working in Shetland, and I was on my own and listening to tapes, and then someone who knew I was an AA said, I see you're recruiting. And I says, well, what? And he says, oh, there's a notice up. And sure enough, on the notice board, there was it was a massive construction camp. There was 2,500 people in it. And there was a notice up, and it said, it was our usual, do you need help? Or no, do you have a drinking problem? Perhaps we can help. And it was covered in graffiti. You know, I mean, all the guys that worked there, there was a lot of drinking went on in this construction camp, and there was a lot of kind of comments like, no, I don't have a problem, but wee Wally, who lives in room 272, has got a problem. And yeah, my biggest problem is I can't get enough money or I can't get enough drink. Anyway, so I found out there was another AA member there, and I contacted him, and it turned out there was another two AA members. So there was four of us, and we decided to start a meeting in the camp. And in January 1978, we started the Sullen Vaux group of Alcoholics Anonymous. So there was four of us, but one of us was generally away on holiday. So there was three of us. Most weeks there was only three of us. And we decided to base the meeting on the West of Scotland meetings, which were 2 hours long. So we had this situation where we had one person at the top table who spoke for an hour, and then we had... We used to say, now this is the best part of the meeting where we go round the room and there was two other speakers. And it was like, Wally, would you like to share? And Wally would get to share for half an hour. And then it was Jockey, would you like to share? And Jockey would get to share for half an hour. And believe it or not, some nights the meetings ran over. I mean, it was unbelievable. And eventually in time, more people came, and more sober people came from the mainland to work there, and then eventually we also had a meeting going in Lerwick, which was the capital of Shetland, which was 27 miles away, and eventually Shetlanders started coming, and they eventually took over their own meeting in time when they got sober long enough, and we had our meeting in the camp. And one night at our meeting in the camp, there was 32 of us. Was like a convention, really. This was after 4 years. It was wonderful. Anyway, I came to AA 40 years ago, just now. It was the end of March 1975, and I was just turned 29. I was homeless. I was living on the streets of London, and it was a bit different than it is today. Nobody gave you sleeping bags. There was hardly any kind of food kitchens or anything. You would be arrested if you were caught sleeping in the streets. You would have been arrested. They still done the Vagrancy Act then. If you didn't have more than 50 pence, they could charge you with vagrancy. So I was homeless. I was sleeping in toilets or whatever. And I was only 29, and did I think I was an alcoholic? Probably not. I was drinking with guys on the streets who were alcoholics. I drank with guys who drank meths. I never drank meths, but some of these guys drank meths and cheap wine. I was panhandling. I was up to all sorts of no good to get money for booze. And recently I was out, one of my friends from America, an AA friend from America was visiting, and I was walking past, we were out walking, and we were passing Parliament, and I said, see those little gardeners there? I says, I ended up at the end of my drinking, sitting there, drinking cheap wine, and I was a big fit man. I was 29, but I was, you know, I was still pretty fit. But my head had got me to the stage where I'd be sitting on a bench, and I was hoping that some rich woman would sit down beside me and say, "My, why are you sitting here alone?" And I would then kind of tell her my sob story. And that, you know, some rich divorcee from Knightsbridge, hopefully. And she would then say to me, "Oh, there. Why don't you come home with me? I'll feed you. I'll buy all your clothes. I'll take care of you and give you as much sex as you want. And I'll buy all your drink." It never happened. I was sitting there with this thing in my head. It never ever happened. I got all sorts of people sitting down beside me. On occasions, you get some old gay guy would sit down and say, "You busy this afternoon?" And that's the way I was the day before I came to AA. And if you'd said to me, Tomorrow, you're going to phone Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've said, why? Why would I phone AA? I'm only 29. And didn't think I was an alcoholic. And yet I did. The next day I phoned AA. And I was actually in the process of committing a crime. I'm not a criminal. I've never really been a criminal-minded person. But I was in the process of committing a crime solely for getting money for drink. That's all I wanted. I just wanted money for drink. I didn't have any plan of escape. You know, I hadn't worked out how I was going to get away with this crime. But I just thought, if I can get away with this, I'll get money for drink. Anyway, I stopped before I'd done anything and thought, there's something wrong. There is something really seriously wrong with me. And I thought, I'm going to phone Alcoholics Anonymous. And it cost 2 pence. And I got the operator. And I said, "Could you give me the number for Alcoholics Anonymous, please?" And she said, "Do you want me to put you through?" And I said, "Yeah, that'd be great." And I spoke to a woman called Mary, who used to run the office in London, Redcliffe Gardens. And Mary said, "Do you have problems with your drinking?" And I said, "Oh, I've got problems with it." It was full of the poor me's. I know this now, but, "Oh, God, I'm homeless, I'm hungry, I think I'm going crazy, I'm not looking after my hygiene, and I drink a lot." And she said, "Would you like to go to a meeting?" And I said, "Yeah." And she gave me directions of how to go to the meeting at Aldgate East, which is a lunchtime, Wednesday lunchtime meeting. And I got there, and I walked in, and in the kind of entrance foyer, there was little signs that said AA. So I walked into this room, and there was about a dozen people standing, drinking tea out of nice cups and saucers. And there's people with suits on, some guys with suits. It was in the city. It was generally for people who worked in the city. Some couple of women who were nicely dressed. And I thought I was in the wrong place. I thought, "Oh, God, this is the church vestry meeting or something." And I walked back out again, and the wee sign said, "AA, in here." And I thought, "Oh, God, it must have been in another room." Anyway, so I walked back in again, and this man came over and said to me, "Who are you looking for, son?" Now, he knew fine well who I was looking for. And I says, "I'm looking for AA." And he says, "My name's Peter, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'll tell you something, never underestimate the power of a handshake." I've never forgotten that man. I've never forgotten him. And then I said, "I don't drink methylated spirits." And Peter said to me, "Son, doesn't matter how much you drank, how often you drank, or what you drank. He says, what happens when you drink? And for some reason, and you know, now when I'm talking to people about people like us, alcoholics, you know, we're not stupid people on the whole, we're generally quite clever. And yet, when it comes to alcohol, there's a blind spot. You know, I'm not a stupid guy, and yet I couldn't see that for the years that I'd been drinking, that drink was causing me all this bother. Anyway, that was my first meeting. Also at that meeting, I'm not stupid. I realised there was a couple of guys with pinstripe shirts who worked in the city. They were traders. And immediately I'm thinking, must be a couple of bob in here, the people working in here. And I thought, maybe, because they sounded really caring and sharing, you know. And I thought, maybe he's got a wee hotel or something like that where they put up homeless people. So they'll probably put me 2-star. I wasn't hoping for anything better than 2-star, Paddington or Victoria or something. And it got to the end of the meeting, and I thought, when are they going to fix me up with my accommodation? And the guy who was the secretary, who was a bank manager, came over and said to me, where did you say you were sleeping or staying at the moment, Robert? And I thought, this is it, they're going to sort. And so I put on my most humble voice. And I says, I'm sleeping in the streets at the moment. And he patted me in the back. He says, keep coming back. Things will get better. And it was like, what? Where's my room? Anyways, and I learned that first day that we're not a handout organisation. Although in saying that, it doesn't mean to say that we can't help our fellow alcoholics who are in need sometimes on occasion, either by maybe buying them breakfast or maybe giving them a couple of bob. So that was my first meeting, and I got hope at my first meeting. I remember thinking, that's what's wrong with me. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I didn't know why I'd ended up, my career had been terminated, my marriage had finished, I was in the streets panhandling. I couldn't understand why all this had happened. Now, for the first time, I realised, that's what's wrong with me. And they said to me, can you get to bed tonight without taking a drink? They actually said, can you get to another meeting this evening? And I did. I went to the Caxton Group, which is still going, which is one of the first meetings in London. And I realised, and they spoke about the first drink, someone said to me, you need never drink again. And I was like, what? Because I didn't know anything about AA. I didn't know what the procedure was. But I remember leaving there and thinking, maybe, there's a way out of this. So that was my first meeting. How did I end up there? Obviously I'm Scottish. I come from just outside Glasgow, Coatbridge. And my parents died when I was young. They used to have to wear National Health Specs. I don't know if any's ever worn National Health Specs. These little round things, which I hated, and I hated the teacher saying, Robert, put your glasses on. Ironically, I hated them, and about 8 or 9 years later, John Lennon started wearing them, and everybody wanted to wear these wee round glasses. And we were quite poor. I'd say my parents had died, and at 14, I bought drink. I'd tasted drink. It had been sips of drink, but I tasted it. I first bought it when I was 14, half bottle of VP wine. Don't know if anybody ever drank VP, but it was cheap. That's all I can say about it. It was like paint stripper, but I've seen other people drinking it. And I used to hold my nose when I was drinking it, pour it over. And me and my pal bought it to impress a couple of 13-year-olds. And they were impressed. They were simply impressed. You know, you've been drinking? Yeah, with a bottle of wine. It was half a bottle of wine between us. And I think, actually, I acted drunk. Because I'd seen drunks. I'd seen lots of drunks. I think I actually acted a wee bit kind of as if I was drunk. And then maybe another few months later, I bought another half bottle of wine. And then I left school at 15, as you could then, and became an apprentice carpenter, joiner. And my drinking really just kind of took off then. And it became a weekly thing. Most weeks, half bottles of wine, bottles of, you could buy cider, one of the pubs, in the off license, and And that was my adventure into drinking. Little did I know then, this thing that was offering me so much, because I thought, yeah, it kind of makes me a bit loose and I can talk and, you know. And little did I know the journey this was going to take me on. The next big event that happened in my life, which I would love to tell you, I was 15, I would love to tell you it was sex. It wasn't sex. It was getting served in a pub, which was a big thing. Getting served in a pub was a big thing. And me and my pal had went to the dance. We were going to the dancing. I think we drank some wine. And we decided that we would go into this pub. Every town's got pubs that serve underage drinkers, and this pub was known for that. And we went into the back room of the pub and rang the bell, which is where the phrase "who's on the bell" comes from. And the barman, one of the barmen, came in, and I remember the two of us were sitting, and I was the biggest, and I was like, "2 pints, a light, please." And he went away and got us them, and it was like we'd been served. Jesus, we're being served. And they brought them back in again, and brought the pints in, and we drank them, and then rang the bell again. I'm a wee bit more confident now. Another 2 pints, please. And then by the time we were getting the third one, it was like, 2 pints there, big man. The guy was about 5'3". Hey, Jimmy, 2 pints there. And then going away across to the Pally, and telling people I'd drank. I was over in the Waverley Bar, I think it was 7 or 8 pints. 3 pints, you know, it's like exaggeration. Anyway, I loved drinking. I loved it. I never really knew why I was loving it. I thought I was shy. I thought alcohol would take away my shyness. I wasn't shy. I learned that in AA. I'm not shy. I'm anything but shy. What I learned in AA was that I was frightened of rejection. I was self-centered. I had low self-worth. I felt insecure a lot of the time. I didn't like criticism. All this sort of stuff. But I'm not shy. But I thought I was shy, and I thought we'd drinking, and I thought it'd give me confidence to ask girls. You had to ask girls to dance. And I'd go over and say, "Would you like to dance?" And if a girl said no, that was me finished for the rest of the evening. I'd stand in the corner. I think, this dance is crap. Don't know why we come here. Desperately wanting to be on the floor. Desperately wanting to be up dancing. And I had a pal, Pat, who was quite smaller than me and quite dumpy. Pat used to go up and say, "Do you want to dance?" "No." "Do you want to dance?" "No." "Do you want to dance?" Pat would go right down the line at the Pally. Get to the bottom and go back up the line again. "Do you want to dance? Do you want to dance?" And eventually some lassie would always say, "Aye, okay, Pat." And Pat would up. Pat danced every dance at the Pally, because Pat didn't let rejection bother him. He didn't take it personally. Anyway, I used to get involved in bits of fighting and things like that, and a bit stupid. And then I joined the army when I was 18. I ran away from a situation at work. Most people would have took a day off. And there was a problem at work, and I was 18. I was actually in charge of this job. There was a problem, and it's fearful. So instead of taking a day off, or instead of taking the week off, or even packing my job in, what did I do? I joined the army. Went away and joined the army. I joined the Scottish Regiment, gave me a nice tartan trousers, a nice Glengarry, and then I was given money. The army were feeding me. Suddenly my money was mine to spend, and I spent it on drink. And very quickly I ended up in trouble in the army, and for the next few years I was continually in trouble. I was spending all my money. It seemed I was spending most of my money on booze. And by this time I was 18, 19, and by this time I thought I was a big time drinker. You know, I mean, I could drink and still stay on my feet, which used to impress people. And that, it's sad to say that that's how you were judged. You could, you know, if you could fight or you could drink a lot, it impressed people. And I spent time, I get fined in the army, I get confined to barracks, I get put in jail numerous times, I ended up getting court-martialed and sent to the army prison, and And never once did I think this is a direct result of me and my drinking. It was always bad luck. I used to think it was bad luck. And I'd come out of jail or whatever and carry on drinking. I smoked, and it never occurred to me, well, I better keep money for during the week for my fags. I would just drink all my money, and then I'd beg, borrow, steal for the rest of the week. And then when I was 21, I got married. I'd had a relationship with this lassie. If she was here, she would laugh at the word relationship. You know, we're saying, who are you kidding, relationship? It was on, it was off, it was on, it was off, it was on, it was off. We got engaged, then it kind of broke up, and then we get engaged. Oh, people didn't know what was happening. And then we get married. And I thought that'd be it. I thought, and my family, my aunties who'd kind of looked after us, were saying, oh, that's good, Robert's now got a wife, he'll settle down now and stop all this stupid carry on. And really, that's what I thought would happen. My other two brothers would get married and settled. They were never as bad as me, but I mean, they'd settle down and started having children. And I thought, that's what I'll do. That's what I wanted to do, a really pretty wife. And it was okay, but when I was drinking, there were still bits of problems. And it says in our book, in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, lack of power was our dilemma. For quite a while, for the first number of years I was drinking, lack of money was my dilemma. I used to run out of money. And when I ran out of money, I stopped drinking. And then the army sent me to Germany. And suddenly, with my wife, to Berlin, and suddenly the problems about running out of money had gone, because booze was duty-free for the soldiers, so were the cigarettes, and plus they gave you extra money for being there. And suddenly it was like eureka. You know, it was half-pint glasses, litre bottles of booze. We used to have parties in the house, and you would end up, people brought that much booze with them, you ended up with more booze than you started with. At the end, I used to try and get, no, they were going nuts, because it was so cheap. And it then became serious drinking, and it then became kind of a lot of consequences. There'd been consequences before, but suddenly there was more consequences. And it was like, then there was a lot of crying, there was a lot of shouting, arguing, sleeping in separate rooms, not talking for days sometimes. There, your dinner, okay, fine. Do you want tea? No, okay. Drinking. And then I'd be crying and saying, and then we'd make up, and oh, I promise, I'll never do it again. I promise you, that's it. I'll never do it again. I'll never do it again. And that was my intention. I mean, I didn't want any of this carry on going on, but I didn't know about alcoholism. I didn't know about the first drink. I didn't really know what made me tick, really. Even though I was kind of conducting myself as a soldier and doing my job. And then drama, the army sent me back to Britain after about 18 months in Germany. Suddenly no duty-free booze, back to paying the proper price for drink. And that was a bit of a culture shock. It curtailed my drinking, obviously, but I was still getting into wee bits of bother. And then the army sent me back again to Germany for another 3 years. And if it had been bad the first time, it suddenly started getting kind of seriously bad. And I was ending up, I'd be hungover, terrible hangovers. I mean, I've heard people saying they didn't have hangovers when they were drinking. I had terrible hangovers when I was drinking. I spent a lot of time with my head down the toilet pan, thinking my stomach was going to come out, thinking that I'd be looking in the mirror saying, never again, never again, never again. And I'd be drinking, I drink Alka-Seltzer. I don't know if anyone's known about Alka-Seltzer. It's supposed to be a teaspoonful of this stuff in a glass. I was putting a big heap tablespoonful, and the foam would be coming out. I'd be drinking it, I was so dehydrated, and trying all sorts of stuff. I used to end up taking Lemsips. I wasn't even putting them in hot water. I used to pour the Lemsips straight into my mouth. You all right, young man? Nice to see you, Jack. And again, you know, there was a lot of problems. There was a lot of crying. A lot of, I'll stop, I'll never do it again. I was staying out late at night. I was drinking in bars. I've drank in bars in Germany. I mean, my children are grown up now. I'd be embarrassed to take my children into these bars. Really, I mean, talk about... It says in chapter 11, we sort out sordid places. I mean, I drank in some really sordid places. And I changed drinks. I tried changing my drinking. Oh, it's a big, you know, I was drinking Bacardi. Oh, right, I'll stay off the Bacardi. I'll drink beer. I'll just drink beer. And one of the things I learned is that pubs and, you know, places that we drink, they're full of doctors, full of lawyers, full of accountants, or so we think we are. You know, we're giving advice to everybody about everything, you know. Nah, don't mix the grape and the barley. Don't drink in an empty stomach. That was favourite in Scotland. Don't drink in an empty stomach. Make sure you get yourself a lining. Yeah, sure, so that when you're sick, you bring everything up. You know, it's like, drink a pint of milk. I don't know who came up with that one. Drink a pint. It gives you a lining in your stomach. Yeah, sure it does. I mean, the pint of milk comes up along with all the rest of it. And all this stuff about what we should do, don't drink when you're tired. And the other one, I'd fall into the house, and my wife would say, look at the state. I was all right until I had the fresh air, you know. And I've been breathing fresh air since the day I got sober. It didn't seem to have done me any harm, you know. And yet I blamed it for the state I used to get into. Chinese takeaways, whatever. And my drinking was becoming serious then, and I was drinking at work. I hated it. You know, if I went at lunchtime, I'd be gorging myself with drink, and then having to go back to work and thinking, oh, I wish I hadn't went for that drink, because I wanted more then. Once I had a drink, I wanted more. I didn't know about the first drink and about the obsession. And anyway, I stopped drinking loads of times. But it kept catching up with me. I kept picking up drink, and I was getting into bother. I started getting into bother with the army again, and I just couldn't understand. I mean, I had everything. I remember talking to a young soul. I was drinking a bar at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm telling this young soldier who was single, who'd every right to be there, I'm telling him about, oh, I've got a beautiful wife and I've got a lovely home, and he says, what are you doing here? And he was right. What was I doing there at 2 o'clock in the morning? You know, I had everything really that a lot of people wanted. And yet I was hanging off a bar. I'll go after the next one. And I'd find myself still there at 5 o'clock in the morning. And I mean, I'd love to tell you that I used to wake up beside all these beautiful women. A lot of times I woke up, I was like in a telephone box or under bushes. I woke up inside a cardboard box once. When I woke up, I didn't know where I was. I was all curled up inside this cardboard box. And crazy places I ended up. And coal cellars, anywhere. But I didn't know. I didn't know about alcoholism. And despite my valiant attempts of changing drinks, changing places, taking out less money, I still just seem to keep getting into bother with drink. And inevitably, as I said at the start, my marriage deteriorated and collapsed. My career in the army collapsed. And the army just terminated my service. There was no drama. There was no court-martial or anything. They just said, son, you've become a real liability now. We can't really afford to have you. So they terminated my service and sent me on my merry way. And I remember thinking, how are they going to manage without me? Well, they seem to have done all right so far, but anyway. But when I was leaving, there was an RSM who was in charge of me, and he said to me, son, he says, if you don't watch what you're doing, he says, you're going to end up in the grass market. The grass market was a place in Edinburgh. I was stationed in Edinburgh at the time. The grass market was a place where all the down and outs ended up. I didn't know that at the time. He said, if you don't watch what you're doing, he says, you're going to end up in the grass market. And I just gave him a look. I didn't even know what he was talking about. Anyway, and that's how I ended up in London. Confused, totally confused. I didn't want to do anything else. All I wanted to do was drink, as I said at the start. I just wanted to drink. I was a big, fit young man. I was more than capable of going out to work. But I didn't want to do that anymore. I just wanted to. I wanted to live in this Walter Mitty world of make-believe. You know, I didn't want to be fall down drunk. I didn't want to be falling asleep drunk. I just wanted to be in this wee world of my own, of make-believe. And I didn't know I was an alcoholic until that day I went to AA. It wasn't my last drink that day, it was last drink for a period. That was 1975. I went back to Scotland, stayed sober, and got back with my wife, who was a bit bemused when I said I was an alcoholic. And she went, really? Because she was the same as me. Most people have got an opinion of what an alcoholic is. If you went out and stopped everybody in the street and said, what's an alcoholic? And you'd end up with all sorts of versions of what people think are alcoholics, including my own before I came to AA. And my wife was a bit confused. Her family were a bit confused. My two brothers were a bit confused. They wouldn't drink with me at the end of my drinking, but they didn't think it was that bad. You weren't that bad, but they wouldn't drink with me. Anyway, I stayed sober. I went to meetings in Coatbridge, where I come from. I was quite happy. It was very funny. A lot of funny guys up there, and women. And I loved it, as the previous speaker spoke about. There were a lot of characters. Everybody had, not everybody, but all the people who had been sober a while had nicknames. Meat Market Bobby, Scrap Rab, Nurse Jean, Barber Bill, you know, Easter House Alec. All these different, Press Jimmy. Jimmy worked for the Express, and he was known as Press Jimmy. Press Pat, another guy who worked for the Express, was known as Press Pat. All these different characters, and good fun, and very enthusiastic about being sober, as the last speaker spoke about. Good men and women who were in love with you, who loved being sober. I mean, I look back now and I think, thank God for these people. You know, thank God. The man that helped me came to AA in 1955, when there was no cars. People didn't have cars. Most people didn't have phones, telephones. So when they were going to meet people who were 12-stepping people, they had to go to their homes, pick them up, walk to a bus stop, and then jump the bus, and then maybe get a train into Glasgow or whatever, really. But they did. They made the effort, thankfully. So I was quite happy. I was going to these meetings. Yeah, but I wasn't too happy about getting somebody to sponsor me. You know, I got a sponsor, somebody to help you, son. Yeah. I've got a high IQ, you know. I thought, do I really need somebody to help me? Yeah. Maybe not, you know. What about Andy? Nah. What about Jack? Nah. I'll manage on my own. I'll manage. And what about the steps? I used to hear people saying, oh, I've been doing step 4 now for 3 months and 6 months. I used to think, you must be stupid. What? Taking months? I'll do these steps some weekend I'm not busy. On my own, without help. And anyway, I was going to the meetings. I was happy enough. And then I got a job. And then, well, that was the other thing. Initially, I was thinking, no, I'm 30 by this time. Just, you know, I'm 29, going on 30. Big, fit young man. Sitting in the house thinking, oh, I'll never work again. I'm an alcoholic. I'll never work again. And I really wanted God, the same as before I came, where I wanted this rich woman to come and look after me. I had now reached the point I'm sober, but I didn't want to work. I wanted God to put a cheque through my door every week. Nah, don't you worry, son, you go to meetings, I'll pay your rent, I'll pay your electricity. And the man that helped me, what had happened at the time before this, I was going to meetings, nobody to help, telling... In Scotland, they used to go around the room, you know, do you want to speak, do you want to speak? Robert, do you want to say, aye, oh, yeah, being sober's great, aye, aye. I was demented, I was full of fear. I didn't know about any of this stuff, because I wasn't talking to anybody. Full of fear, full of anger, full of jealousy, full of resentment. No, no, oh, great, I love being sober, oh, it's great being sober. I was a mental wreck. I'm not telling you that, because I'm 6 foot, I should be able to look after myself. And the outcome was that inevitably... I started taking umbrage at the meetings. I'd be sitting there thinking, some guy would say, and you know, I haven't been working now for four, oh, he's looking for a job. Some lassie would maybe say, oh, you know, and I'm a bit lonely, she's looking for a man. Somebody else would say something, they're looking for this. And somebody else would say, and I need some carpentry. Oh, she knows I'm a joiner. You know, I was taking everybody's inventory. I was full of resentment. I remember a guy saying, thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous, me and my wife are going away on our first holiday to Tenerife. And I remember saying, oh, that's nice. And in my head, I'm thinking, I hope it rains. I thought I was sane, by the way. Right? I hope it rains. And then God forgive me. See, when I think, and then I remember thinking, maybe he'll drink and I'll be longer sober now. He won't be so smart then. Well, he never drank, but I did. I drank. And it ended up, what happened was that I started drifting away from AA. I'm not going to that meeting. The tea's rubbish. I'm not going to that meeting. Somebody never shook my hand. I'm not going to that meeting. They talk too much about God at that meeting. I'm not going there. They're not talking enough about stabbing. We need to hear a bit more about stabbing in Berlini and think, oh God, my head was all over the place. And I wasn't talking to anyone. And what happened was that I just drifted away from AA. And very quickly, what had happened was that, say, the meetings were for 2 hours in the west of Scotland. So I started getting to the meetings just as they started, so I wouldn't have to talk to anybody. And then I started leaving a bit early. And then I was leaving about half an hour early. And I thought, I can't go home, because my wife was saying, why are you home so early? And then I had a brainwave. Or the devil had a brainwave. Why don't you go and stand in the pub and drink Coca-Cola? And I started going to the pub and drinking Coca-Cola. And I'm drinking my Coca-Cola. And they're all drinking lager. And very quickly, I ended up the guy drinking the lager. And that was 1976, the hot summer. And I drank for the whole of July 1976. And I was straight back to where I came from. I mean, there wasn't any period of grace because I'd been off drink for about 14 months. It was, I was straight at it with a vengeance. Ended up leaving my wife again, homeless, panhandling. And then on the 1st of August, I remember waking and I was homeless again. I remember thinking, what did I do? What do you do? Because before I came to AA, I didn't know. I can put my hand on my heart. I didn't know that I was an alcoholic. I didn't know about the first drink. But I now knew. I now knew there was a way out. I'd met people, Jimmy, Frank, Guy, in our group that I used to go to in Coatbridge, who were sober 18, 20 years. So I knew that sobriety was doable. So what do I do? And thankfully, on the 1st of August, I come back to AA, and I've been back here since then. I didn't know then I was going to stay sober to now. You don't know if you're even going to live to now. But I come back, and I eventually asked a man if he would help me. Sometimes it takes courage in AA, I think, to ask somebody for you, because a lot of us are quite, we think we're self-sufficient. I'm not going to tell Andy. I'm frightened. I'm not going to tell Andy this. So I got this man to help me, Frank Diamond, and he was great. He was a great old troubadour and our trooper, and Frank was, you know, he wasn't a kind of massively big book guy, but he was a man full of good sense. You know, he came to AA in 1955, and he spoke to me about things like, we're a mixed bunch in here. I remember saying to Frank, after a period of being with Frank, I mentioned that. I said, you know, see if people were like us, Frank. He says, what? I said, see if people were like us in AA. If people like me and you. I says, AA would be great. And he says, son, if they're all like you, he says, I wouldn't come. And it was like, what? I was a bit miffed. And he says, if they're all like me, I wouldn't come either. He says, we're a mixed bunch in here, son. He says, some people in here believe in God. Some people don't like the word God. Some people are striving to find God. He says, some people think they even are God. You know, he says, get a seat. Grab yourself a seat in here. He says, we're a mixed bunch of people. And, you know, over all the years I've been sober, on occasions when meetings, you know, sometimes meetings can go a wee bit skew with, or some of the sharing's a wee bit skew with. And I always think to myself, mixed bunch. Next bunch of people in here, you know. you got to live your life as best you can. He taught me about the devil sitting on my shoulder. He says, don't think he goes away. He says, always there, nip, 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 nip. And that's been true. You know, it's he encouraged me to sit up the front. He knew I was a big Elvis Presley fan. He says, if Elvis Presley was appearing here tonight, he says, you wouldn't be sitting in the back row, would you? I says, no. He said, well, this is more important than Elvis Presley. And then he said, there's less distraction. And he knew me. He knew that if I was sitting at the back, I'd be sitting looking and thinking, he needs a haircut. She's got nice legs, you know, or whatever. You know, it's... So I try now, when I go to meetings, I try to sit up in front. It's also now, by it's just good for your hearing as well. You can hear a bit better. So I started getting sober. I was married, had 3 children. And I learnt a lot, you know. It, to me, it is about learning, you know. Learning about myself, you know, when I started looking at myself. Step 2, about insanity. I didn't know. I was going to meetings in Coatbridge, and because I'd never been locked up in a psychiatric unit, but in Coatbridge there was quite a lot of the members had been locked up, and sometimes it was like a competition, you know. I was twice in Hartwood, in prison. Twice. I was 4 times in the Southern General, you know. They told me I had the most parentivite shoved up my backside than anybody else in Scotland, you know. I was strapped down to a bed for 4 days, you know, and I hadn't done any of this. So I used to think, they're the ones that are insane. I'm not insane. That's why step two is for them, it's not for me. Anyway, thankfully, Frank sorted me out on that. And then looking at other stuff, you know, when I looked at step 4, which I'd never done, you know, I feel a wee bit kind of sad on occasions. I think, I'd got to that age, and never once had I ever questioned why I behaved, not just in my drinking, just in all my behaviour. I'd never ever thought, why have you done that? Why have you behaved like that? And suddenly here he is asking me to kind of look at myself. And one of the things, which happens to a lot of us, I've heard over the years, is fear. You know, I mean, fear was a thing that was never spoke about. I'd never heard MD in pubs ever talking about fear, or, you know, and, you know, the pub, the shark's mouth, you never hear anybody saying, oh, I'm full of resentment. Nobody ever said things like that, you know, or I'm feeling very anxious, you know, I think you've got self-pity. Well, nobody ever spoke about it in there. Certainly nobody ever hugged MD, as people do in AA. This was all a revelation that suddenly I was finding out about all this stuff. And the other thing was that, and he says, well, you need to tell somebody about this. And step 5, you know, what? What? You want me to tell people some of the stuff that I've done? And which is quite difficult, you know. Who wants to admit to stuff like that? But I did, and it really wasn't that bad. Once I got into it, and Frank said to me, he said, oh, I've done stuff as well. And he started talking about stuff, and, you know, and we get through that. And then the other steps, like step 6 and 7, where it talks about defects of character. And that was another revelation, because when I was drinking, and I met a guy recently who was in the army with all these years ago, and he said to me, he says, you were a great guy. I was a corporal. He says, we all loved you. But they didn't know a lot of what was going on in my drinking. And because then people used to say to me, you're a great, when you're not drinking, you're really a really nice guy, but see, when you're on the bevy, you're a nutter. So I thought, because I stopped drinking, I was great. I thought I didn't have any defects of character. I actually thought, that doesn't apply to me. I don't have any defects of character. I had loads of defects of character. And then when I started looking, I began to realise, oh God. So I'd say it's a learning process, you know what I mean? You know, it says we ask God to take all this stuff. Sure, and then suddenly you wake up the next morning and things are still there. You're just like, I'm supposed to take these away. It didn't work. But it does work. It told me about keep trying it. And Jack, I've known Jack for years. But, you know, I was watching the golf with Andy yesterday. And then you're watching these golfers. And I said to Andy, I says, these guys have hit a lot of golf balls in their life. You know, they didn't just turn up there one day and hit a few balls and say, I'm great. They practiced and practiced and practiced. And that's how they get better. And I'll tell you another story. I bought a guitar in sobriety. And I said to a guy, a famous guy who plays the guitar, who I know, I said, I bought a guitar. He said, oh, that's good. I said, have you got any tips? He said, practice. I said, is that it? He said, I'm afraid that's it. He said, practice. I still can't play it because I don't practice. So I learned about this, keep working, keep working on myself. Make amends. Mostly my amends, practically all of my amends were to my family. I mean, I wasn't somebody who borrowed money. You know, some people get into financial debt. I never kind of borrowed money or anything like that. Most of my amends were to my family, and that was, you know, people I find can be a bit confused with it all, you know. They're like, nah, but you're not drinking now, you're all right. You know, they don't understand why we're trying to do this. But through the internet's a great thing. I found my first girlfriend who I needed to make amends to on the internet, and I did, and, you know, she's since died, but I'm so happy that I found her and we managed to square up my behaviour from when I was young. And then there was also a sergeant major who I went through the internet, and I got all these names with telephone numbers, and I thought, right, the guy came from Yorkshire, so I thought, right, I'll start with the Yorkshire numbers with this name. So the first guy I rang up and say, hi, I'm trying to find this man, told his name. I said, were you in the army? Was I in the army? I was in the fucking Navy. Piss off, you know. And the next guy I rang, no, I wasn't. But the third guy I rang was this sergeant major. Couldn't believe it. He says, yeah, son, that's me. Oh, so we start chatting away. And I was in Ireland in 1974. It was the last year of my drinking. See, this drinking and I caused a lot of bother. Anyway, so we're chatting away. And I said, well, I've been in the AA for a good number of years now. I think I'd probably been sober about 27, 28 years when I managed to contact this guy. And he said, oh, I'm in my 70s now myself, son, and dad, I were talking away different things and that. And I said, well, I just wanted to say, you know, I said, about my behaviour. I says, I'm an alcoholic and I've been going to AA and, you know, my life's improved and that. Oh, that's good, son, that's good. And, you know, I'm sorry for anything. He said, what did you say your name was again? And I says, Robert Nelson. He says, for the love of me, son. He says, I can't remember you. So there we go. Anyway, but you know, the good news was that I'd done what he had asked me. If I'd shown this guy a video of what was happening in 19... And he actually said, he said, I'm quite old now, son. He says, my memory's kind of a bit haywire. If I'd shown him a video of my behaviour, he'd have said, oh, I remember you all right, yeah. But anyway. So there's actually still one guy that I'd like to contact. And the other steps to me are just my daily things. You know, I keep looking at myself and thinking, what can I do to keep myself in a level keel? You know, and most of my sobriety has been fine. You know what I mean? The other thing I learned from Frank Diamond was about trying to help. Frank was always looking for people who were new. He's always wanting to put his hand out and say hello to them, encourage them. And I've tried to copy that, you know. There's nothing worse than going into a meeting with a room full of alcoholics and seeing somebody sitting and saying, hi, how you doing? And finding out they're at their first meeting and nobody's talking to them. Mm. You know, I mean, we read out on occasions, I am responsible. You know, I've got to remember that. I am responsible. I can't be sitting saying, oh, it's his. He should be doing that or he should be doing that. I need to do it. I need to put my hand out. And I got divorced in sobriety. Which meant I live in London now, and that's how I ended up in London. I came to London, and that was pretty tough. You know, I'm an alcoholic. Although I could say to other people, you've got to let go, you've got to let go, you've got to let go. And when it came time for me to let go, it was like, no, I think I'll hang on. Again, and again, and again. And I was going up and down to Scotland trying to get this marriage to work, and it was a hopeless cause. I know that now, but maybe me. I'll make this work. This will work. We'll definitely get it sorted out. And it was ending up as if I was on a cliff, hanging on a cliff. And it was one hand, somebody was standing on my hand, and fucking. And eventually the voice said, "This is God. It's me that's standing on your hands. Let go." And eventually I did let go. And it was a wee bit difficult at the start. You know, suddenly I was back in my own again. I was away from my family, everything, my home, my garden, the dog, everything. And, you know, but you know something? The best thing I've ever done. Best thing I've ever done in my life. I started getting better. And I started, you know, I've always been involved in AA. I believe in service. I believe in, you know, pitching up, being part of a group. I've always been part of a group, tried to be part of a group and play my part in it. If I do a job, Frank Diamond taught me, he said, if you're going to do a job for AA, do it properly. He said, if you don't want to do it properly, don't do it. He says, we can manage without people that are doing it half. Do it, do the job properly. Read up what the job entails and do it properly. And I've tried to do that, you know. And AA has been great, you know. And as we say, you know, AA is full of characters. We're all different people. And I've often shared about, someone was sharing at a meeting recently I was at, and they were saying, oh, you know, somebody in AA doesn't like you. If everybody in AA likes you, you're probably not going to enough meetings. You know, we're full of people who kind of tend to be shop stewards or whatever, and kind of fall out on occasions, personality things. And I, to me, I likened it to when I was in the army. I mean, when I was in the army, there was guys in our platoon, in our company, who I used to fight, physically fight, hated them. And there'd be numerous guys like that. But see, when we were in active service, when we were out in the Yemen, or we were in Ireland, we were all together. We all pulled together because we all knew we depended on one another. And that's the way I look at our fellowship. We might not all see eye to eye about various things, and you know, various. We've all got opinions about everything. But I always say to people, says, we're in AA, we're in active service. You know, we've got to be together. You know, and our first tradition tells us that about unity. Our common welfare comes first. You know, and the other thing I learned about is Frank, you talk to me about traditions, and I always try and talk to people about traditions, about why we need to adhere to them, whether we think it's a great idea or not. If we stick to them, then there's every chance our fellowship will just grow and grow and grow. And it has. I mean, recently, I'm the archivist for Chelsea Intergroup, and which I love. I love it. I met a guy in America a number of years ago. I was at a convention, and this guy had a room practically this size, full of history about alcoholism, about AA. It was amazing. It was just a mass of stuff, and it got me interested, and I became the Chelsea archivist, and it's been great. Most of the time, as an archivist, not much goes on. One day, a guy phoned me up and said, "I've got a London meeting list from 1972," which got me really excited. It's amazing we can get me excited now. This. And he says, do you want to hang on and I'll see? I says, he lived. I says, I'll be there in 5 minutes. And I jumped my bike and cycled down. And the AA, from 1972, the AA London meeting list was 5 pages. Now it's 61, I think. You know, there was about 70 meetings. Now there's over 800 in that meeting list. And recently, I was at Intergroup, as I'm the archivist, and a guy came in from the Caxton Group, which I'd went to, funnily enough, in my first day of sobriety. And he says, Robert, he says, this canvas bag has been lying about our group forever. He says, and somebody says, give it to Robert Nelson, he's the archivist. And in this bag were minutes from 1953, 54, 55, 56, from when our fellowship in the UK, I mean, the first meeting was 1947, A get kind of going in 1948. Our fellowship was a fledgling society. And here were the minutes. There was like 5 people ran AA in London. And then there were, in 1953, there was 22 meetings in the whole of England. 22 meetings. And a meeting, or 22 groups. And a group might have consisted of 2 people or 3 people. And every 3 months, this central committee of 5 people done the report, and they used to meet up in London generally, And the group reps from these other groups would come and they'd read what the committee had said was happening, and then they would have a meeting then about where our fellowship was going. And I mean, you think of that and how we've grown. In 1955 there was 47, so they doubled from two years. They doubled the numbers of groups, and it's great reading all these minutes about all the conflicts and different opinions, different people, how they were getting into hospitals, how they're trying to get into prisons. I mean, I look at it now and I think we've come a long way, you know. Our fellowship, you know, I love it. I love being sober. I love the people in it. I've got a lot of really good friends. I mean, Andy and Lizzie's wife, Liz, are friends of mine and who I've known for years. Has it always been easy? And it's not always been easy being sober. You know, it's, but it's always been worth it. It's always been worth it. And not sure where I am. Recently I was, I get invited to, before I retired just over 2 years ago, just before I retired, the company I worked for, they run the Singapore Grand Prix. They're a Singaporean company. And but anyway, one of the head members, I was a building manager at the building, and one of the head members walking through, and he said to me, was that for me, is it? Is that for me? No? I don't know.
No,
sorry.
You've got about 5 minutes.
5 minutes, One of the head men was walking through the garage and he said, oh, Robert, he says, what are you doing on Sunday? I said, I don't think I'm doing anything. Why? He said, do you want to go to the Silverstone, to Formula One? No, I've never been to Formula One. I watch it on television on occasions. I don't go out my way to watch it, but, you know, if it's on, I'll watch it. And I thought, yeah, that'd be a nice, interesting thing. So anyway, he says, okay, I'll see you here on Sunday. He says, there's six of us going. So we turn up on Sunday, and he gives us these things. He says, we're going to the Paddock Club. I mean, we're in Berkshire. Most of you have probably been to the Paddock Club. It's like £1,500 for the Sunday ticket, or £1,600 or something. So we arrive there, and tell me, this was the great and the good. You know, you arrive and you've got all these beautiful people there with trays of champagne and all dressed beautifully. And, we're given these special badges that we can go all over the place. And the guy was great. The guy that took me was great. He was a great host. He looked after me. He took me down the pits, introduced me to people, introduced me to some personalities, showed me the best place to stand. Everything great. But we're having lunch, and I mean, we're in this really nice kind of restaurant thing they have, and big tables of 10, and there's film stars and football players and all sorts of people. And so we're sitting at this table, and Terry was all around the table. And the guy on my left said to me, he said, do you not drink alcohol at all, Robert? And I says, no, I don't. And so he, sorry. He picks up his, he says, that's a pity. And I says, why? And he picks his glass up. He says, I'm a bit of a wine buff. He says, this is an amazing wine. I says, really? And I picked my orange juice up. And says, this is an amazing orange juice. And he looked. I says, I'm not kidding you. I says, I don't know where to get the oranges for you. I said, this is the best orange juice I've drank in a long time. And they started smiling, and they went, touche. And then he said, did you ever drink? I said, oh, yes. And he went, ah. But you know the good news? The best news? Because of you people, and because of the examples of the people who were there before me, not for 1 second, not for 1 second, did I wish I was the guy drinking the wine. And that's because of you people and what you've taught me. And I want to thank you for that. Being sober's great. It is great. But more importantly, let's all get to bed tonight without drinking a drink. Because really, that's what this is all about. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad this is being recorded so everyone can have the benefit of hearing you. That was great. I think we're going to take a short break now. And can we just bear in mind that tradition seven, but we're not going to sort of pass the pot. We'll because this meeting is this convention is self-supporting. Bear in mind there's a bucket at the back, but and tea and coffee will be served behind. Is tea and coffee being behind us there? Yeah, super. Okay, and if we just say the Serenity Prayer, please. God, grant me serenity
to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Stay off a drink.
Thank you. And if we can all come back by 12 o'clock, please, to hear our next speaker. Thank you.